Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. The weekend saw graduation gatherings, backyard barbecues, memorials, and visits to the lake. Many of those gatherings were adapted to life during a pandemic. Others were business as usual. Will we see increases of COVID-19 in the state following Memorial Day weekend? Or are South Dakotans still working hard to contain the spread of the contagion? What do we know about this virus that we didn't know just a week before? And does the summer visitor season change predictions for keeping our healthcare facilities from being overwhelmed with those seeking care? Dr. Shankar Kura is Vice President of Medical Affairs at Monument Health, and he's joining us today for our weekly coronavirus update. Dr. Kura, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Lori. Pleasure to be with you.
I want to start with what's new with this virus, and the CDC kind of adapted their guidelines or adapted the prioritization of their guidelines. It's causing a little bit of confusion. I had several people tell me over the weekend that you can't catch this virus from surfaces, and so they were wondering why we're bothering sanitizing everything, and that's not quite the full picture. So give us an update about what we know now that we maybe didn't know before, and let's start with how is this virus transmitted? Can you get it from touching surfaces?
Yes, a quick answer to that one. So some of the confusion about the guidelines, these are meant to reflect the probability rather than a absolute certainty of getting from one way or another. As we all know, the standard mechanism of transmission is similar to the previous SARS, the previous coronavirus MERS, and influenza virus. So the actual transmission is still predominantly person to person and through respiratory droplets if you're within 6 feet or 2 meters of an individual. And of course, the virus can be transmitted through the surfaces, but that probably is the lowest odds of getting it.
Do we continue then our environmental cleaning and our wiping out of our groceries? And, you know, do we need to change? Can we relax some of the things that we've been doing before? Or should you just keep, I guess what I'm wondering is, you know, do we know something now that would change anything in our behavior that we've been doing for the past several months?
Yeah, I wouldn't change disinfecting your hands, your surfaces, that especially the high-touch surfaces like doorknobs. As far as groceries itself, you do the normal cleaning. And when you bring things in from the grocery store or from the mail, those don't have to be as rigorously as you would like washing your hands, because there the transmission likelihood is extremely low. What the CDC guidelines are probably intending to do is keep the focus on the most prevalent forms of transmission, which is hand hygiene, respiratory hygiene, covering your mouth when you sneeze and cough, and wearing a mask in public so that you are not the spreader or the cause for spreading the infection.
One of the things I've noticed in my own personal life is that the habit of not touching my face is, I think, finally taking hold because for whatever reason, that was one of the hardest things for me. Like, I'd never noticed how much I had done that. Yeah. And so I want to ask you about habits as we go forward, because some of these habits and the things that we're doing, we hope that we, you know, aren't going to have to do anymore. Others, I think, could be lifelong, like washing your hands and paying attention to how you touch your face and where and when and whether you've washed your hands. Talk a little bit about just that, you know, people building up the habits of living a little bit differently for those things that really aren't that disruptive to our lives. Washing your hands the way you should is not really a disruptive thing to ask people to do.
Yes, I love the question. It's exactly what Atul Gawande, in an article, famous article now, talked about slow change. Hand hygiene is something that was discovered, you know, centuries ago, but it took more than a few hundred years to become at least a accepted infection prevention practice. And then to still have that be at 100% still a challenge, even in the best of institutions. So we kind of go around monitoring this. We report each unit in each floor in the hospital, and that's kind of something that when you ask about habits, makes a lot of sense. As you can see, even in an institution where we have rules and we have monitors, we catch folks and then remind them. Imagine doing that in a non-institutional setting. You're free to do what you want, but is it the right thing to do? And this is the hardest thing to do, is to wash your hands, not touch your face, cover your face when you sneeze and cough, and be considerate of other folks, because you could be carrying the disease and not know it. So I think this is COVID-19 is a blessing in more ways than a curse, in a lot more ways. I think it's changed a lot of how we look at the world. And also, it brings back, as a society, what's our obligation to each other. I think it's very important we remember that when we consider all these hygienic practices. One other thing I'll say quickly is people try to imagine a world without modern medicine. The three important things that civilization is pretty much dependent upon and has made it possible for us to expect a life of 85 years for most of us are one, hand hygiene and all types of hygiene, two, sanitation, to be able to dispose of all rubbish and the sewage in a sanitary manner. And finally, the most important one, which a lot of folks these days seem to go back on, is vaccination. These three are the only things that have actually changed our life expectancy. Everything else has made minor impacts, not to say the rest of the things are not important, but these three. And as you can see, all these three are, again, a social obligation to each other and quite often forgotten in the heat of argument about the merits of these things.
Yeah. Let's talk about masks for a moment. And some people are really emerging, going back to work for the first time and having to wear a mask, you know, for a 6-hour shift at a retail outlet, for example, and are struggling with, you know, what feels like breathing back your own air. And, you know, if other people aren't wearing a mask, is there any point in me wearing mine? So let's just go over the mask conversation again. Of course, it's becoming kind of political as well. But what I'm really interested in is, you know, what is the best, most effective way to wear a mask? And are they still effective? Do they still have a point right now? Should we still be wearing them?
Another excellent question, one that, as you rightly pointed out, brings about all kinds of viewpoints, political, philosophical, sociological. I think the big one there, and this is kind of, I'm going to say this very carefully, the most important thing is it's a social obligation to protect others. So wearing a mask indicates that you care enough that if you were harboring an infection of any kind, you're less a respiratory infection of any kind, you're less likely to spread it. So that's one. And the other aspect of the mask wearing that people forget is there are certain situations where the mask is more pertinent than others. And the reason we make this universal is, one, it's easier than having people to stop and judge for themselves and then inadvertently and not doing the right thing when it should be worn. What I mean by that is you might have heard of super spreader events. These are what we're epidemiologists are studying. And this COVID-19 in the 3 months that we've 3 to 5 months that we've had it, we are beginning to understand that better. So places like large gatherings and closed congregations like churches, bars, restaurants, and anywhere where there is not just exposure, but duration. So to give you an example, a contrast would be a grocery store. Grocery stores have not been shown to be super spreaders. And the explanation will make us better understand this masking policy. So what a grocery store is different from a church is folks are coming in, there's exposure, but the risk is low because there's not time. The second aspect of epidemiological infection spread is time. The duration in a like in a concert venue or a restaurant or a bar, you're sitting down and you at least spend 15 minutes or long, if not longer, And that's what makes a difference. And that's where the mask becomes effective. So if you're on a subway, train, or a bus, and you're spending 15 to 20 minutes on it with a cohort of others, not knowing who is infected, that's where the mask becomes imperative. It's equally important in the grocery store. I'm not trying to tell you that, but I'm trying to contrast and understand, explain that this infection doesn't transmit. At least the odds of transmission are extremely low when you don't have sufficient time of exposure.
Interesting. All right, outdoors, indoors. It's getting nicer outside, and we, have a pretty good idea that being outdoors is better than being indoors. But does the distance matter outside as well? Do the masks matter outside? Let's talk about being outside, safely.
Yes, distance absolutely matters. And again, this is the two things that we worry about when epidemiologists look at spread of an infection, a respiratory infection of this type, is how close are you? Because that 6 foot distance is very important. People misunderstand that because just walking by someone, because you can't really maintain a full 6 foot distance. It's good to keep that, but if just walking by is not sufficient to spread. The likelihood is more if you actually sat down 6 foot across at, let's say, a picnic bench. So outdoors is great, but you still have to maintain social distancing because you do not want a prolonged period of exposure. That's the key to this. So masking is still good and still important even in outdoors because, as you well know, the summer months. You're not going to have a small gathering. It's always going to be a large gathering. If you go to any park now, you already see lots of folks. They might be far apart, but the longer time they spend next to each other within the 6 foot distance, the more chances of the spread.
When we look at Memorial Day gatherings across the country, clearly there were some that made international news with people behaving, what was considered by many irresponsibly in large gatherings in lakes and beaches. And other people gathered and found the best possible ways to do it. What do we expect if there was a weekend like this where gatherings are more common? Are we going to see an uptick in cases in the next week or two? Like, how can we Are we going to be able to judge if there are consequences to some of those events?
Yes, there's enough data to support the explanation that if you gather in large numbers, the likelihood of a physical and social distancing, which means not coming into contact physically, is diminished enough for this virus to spread. And you might have gone in with your group of folks, maybe a family of four. All it takes is a contact with another person for even brief periods, but with actual contact exposure. And then now, if you look at the actual modeling, it'll quickly spread through like a little fire, if you will, across the entire group.
What do we know about the peak in South Dakota right now? I know we've early on were really challenged to flatten that curve and try not to overwhelm the healthcare system as they had time to prepare. That seems to have been largely successful in South Dakota. We feel good at some about some of those efforts. What do you predict is going to happen in the next, few weeks, or what are we looking at for peak numbers in the state, and has that dialogue changed since some of those early predictions?
Yeah, and Lori, another important question to ask and a difficult one to answer. But if you just look at the numbers that we have objectively, for the first time, if you look at the numbers, South Dakota, the state of South Dakota, is above the national average as far as if you normalize the number of cases. We have roughly 4,600 cases, but if you normalize per million population, that's about 5,260 cases per million South Dakotans. And in the U.S., the entire 50 states, it's only 5,100. So we're above that number. We might be at a stage right now, especially talking West River, we are in a stage where we're going to be seeing a large increase in numbers. How large, the answer is unknown. But we're going to see some numbers. And this number that I just said, above the national average, is an indication of that.
We are concerned about visitor season. We want to be welcoming and open, and such an important part of the economy and an important part of our culture, really. But there is a fear because one of the challenges with the travel, whether it be, you know, across state lines or from Minnehaha County to Pennington County, or, you know, international visitors, should we be concerned? Are we overreacting, underreacting? How should we sort of approach this idea of visitors coming and seeing the great places that we have invited them to see? Challenges there?
Yeah, I think the correct reaction is to fear a opening up to visitors. The underreaction, overreaction part, unfortunately, is always in hindsight. And people, if you did all the right things like we have done so far, and we see less numbers of deaths and infections, that's great. But, you know, if we don't do, it's always in hindsight, we will regret that. I think the correct approach here should be that as far as we are a tourist state and we're proud of our beautiful spaces, the risks are extremely high. We could, because of the nature of our lovely Black Hills, be attracting and probably creating what I would say people write about super spreader summer here in the West Hills.
I want to talk a little bit about treatment and how that has been improving. I know we were at 99 hospitalizations as of the information that was from the state of South Dakota yesterday, and that's across, that's statewide. How are we? Are we getting better at treating people once they present at the hospital? Where are we making improvements?
Yeah, we don't have any treatments. All of our treatment is supportive. So if folks make it, it's because of the excellent supportive care that health systems are providing across the state and across the U.S. Unfortunately, we have seen this play out over and over again, and it's going to be no different for us here in Rapid City or across the state. Or people who have comorbid conditions, one or more pre-existing conditions like diabetes, hypertension, or in other you know, conditions that would put them at risk, are more likely to succumb to it either immediately or in the foreseeable future. What we are most eager to learn and anticipating is a vaccine, which I suspect won't be available an entire year from today, probably in the fall of next year. So that's our only chance against the virus. Right now, our treatments are to support the patient that is unfortunate to have suffered this infection, and hope for them to be able to recover successfully.
Are we looking at, you know, here's what I wanted to ask you. I was toying with what it was, and it was that it's a hydroxychloroquine study from the World Health Organization putting a pause on that. There was a big announcement weeks ago about South Dakota being the first statewide clinical trial, and it was a hydroxychloroquine study. Knowing what we know now, where is that study at? How has that conversation changed? It's not the only clinical trial that South Dakota patients are part of, but it was a widely publicized one. Where is that, especially knowing what we know now about hydroxychloroquine?
I think there are two aspects of that study. One, as far as the World Health Organization, all the studies that have come out, some really good ones, clearly showing that it's more, you know, the side effects are more dangerous than the cure. So that's one, using hydroxychloroquine as a treatment. The study that the state is participating or has been wanting us, the health systems to participate in, is for prophylaxis. So would taking hydroxychloroquine prevent one or help one to recover sooner than someone who has not taken hydroxychloroquine to kind of as a protective medicine. So that one will continue the study, and we'll have to wait and see, like all studies, and that's the nature of science.
Any final thoughts, Dr. Kura, that you want people to know, going forward as we look at nicer weather and more desire to get outside, a little bit of fatigue from the virus, but also some anxiety as the story seems to be pretty consistent. We have to keep doing what we're doing. What's your final message for today for listeners about?
Absolutely.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, Lori, I think the most important thing I would like for our listeners and all of our communities to take away is we should prevent any super spreader events from occurring. So I'll simplify that phrase. It is no gatherings. So unfortunately, we are opening up the economy, but I will go ahead and say this: bars, restaurants, churches, any congregations that have potential for exposure with at least a prolonged period of time, 15 minutes or longer. So all of these places, if I were to advise folks, I'd say don't go to any of these and no public events. And to keep your distance, wear the mask, hand hygiene, and avoid super spreader events. And that's the takeaway. And unfortunately, that's what we're looking at this summer. We're going to see a lot more of that. Hopefully, we won't have the rally. Hopefully, we won't have any of those large gatherings. That would be my advice.
Dr. Shankar Kura is Vice President of Medical Affairs at Monument Health. Thank you so much for being here with us today. We appreciate your time as always.
A pleasure always, Lori. Thank you.